Welcome to Stutter Talk, episode 443 for March 5th, 2014. Today's topic is Counseling in Stuttering Treatment, featuring Dr. David Luderman. Dr. Luderman is an audiologist and is considered a leading expert in counseling people with communication disorders. We are excited to announce that this Stutter Talk episode or course will be available for CEUs for approximately 6 months free of charge through the National Stuttering Association. For complete details regarding the continuing education units, go to the National Stuttering Association's website, westutter.org. Stutter Talk and the National Stuttering Association have one more CEU episode planned. Be sure and check back at stuttertalk.com and westutter.org in the coming weeks. Enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome to Stutter Talk, changing how you think about stuttering one podcast at a time. I'm your host, Peter Reitzis, starting off the show as always with some good voluntary stuttering. I'd like to welcome back to Stutter Talk return guest, Dr. David Luderman. Hey, Dr. Luderman.
Hi.
Dr. David Luderman has a doctorate in education, is a professor emeritus at Emerson College in Boston, Massachusetts, is a fellow of the American Speech Language Hearing Association, and director of the Thayer Lindsay Family Centered Nursery for Hearing Impaired Children. Dr. Luderman has authored many articles and books, including his seminal work, Counseling Persons with Communication Disorders and Their Families, now in its fifth edition. And you've been referred to as a master clinician, Dr. Luderman. And to paraphrase an advisor to Stutter Talk, Walter Manning, he said that if you have a serious interest in counseling, you will get Luderman's book. So those are very kind words.
Thank you.
So I want to share with you here, and you have a great presentation planned, but I want to share with you here at the top of the show that about a year ago, I reread your counseling textbook, and I immediately wrote down two of my favorite quotes and taped them to my computer so that so when I sit down and I do Stutter Talk, I've got them right in front of me. Can I share them with you?
Sure, please do.
So one of the things you wrote is, quote, "The goal of counseling is not to make people feel better, but to separate feelings from non-productive behavior. The feelings must always be acknowledged." I just love that because I've heard so many times speech language pathologists say, "I don't do counseling," or "we don't do counseling." In fact, when I was in graduate school, we were trained that asking a client how they feel is unethical. I'm sure I would hope that's not common, but it certainly was part of my training. So just before you get into your presentation, would you mind sharing for our listeners, how do you define counseling? Or perhaps that is your presentation.
Well, that's all right. Yeah. We can start here now. I had that message in my training program too of not to touch counseling or not to touch feelings. Counseling was defined for me as a grad student as information giving, and that was the counseling. So we would test the client and then we would give our speeches. But when I got out of grad school, I found that was a very ineffective method, because when your emotions are high, you can't process information. Those speeches that I gave, when the client would come back for retesting, didn't remember a word. Because once you start saying, yes, you have a hearing loss, or yes, your child has a hearing loss, or yes, your child stutters, or any kind of diagnostic category that involves emotions and client emotions, you can't process information. So for me, it became essential as part of my career in order to be effective is I realized that I really had to deal with emotions. What helps me a lot with this is we're not dealing with people who are emotionally disturbed. We're dealing with people who are emotionally upset. So for me, and I think you caught it in your quote, is helping people to embrace their painful feelings, because that's where healing is. And by acknowledging them without judging them, that's part of that embracing procedure, so that we can proceed to deal with the content in an effective way.
Mm. So if I understand you correctly, you said there that when you counsel with just content, the client, in this case, the person who stutters, or their family might not be ready to hear the wisdom you have because they're dealing with their emotions and their feelings about the issue.
That's absolutely right.
If you'll permit me, I'll share just one more of your many quotes that I adore. You wrote that acceptance is, quote, reached when the individual realizes that beating the disorder is not always a matter of reaching normalcy, but rather the ability to live life to the fullest in the face of the disorder, end quote. And I love that so much because in speech language pathology, it's so often assumed that we're supposed to take the stuttering away, when in fact that just misses the point so much. And when I read your book and when I taught graduate school and can share your knowledge with my graduate students, it just felt like you were really giving power to the cause of we don't have to be perfect, fluent, non-stuttering speakers. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
So, Dr. Luterman, let me turn the floor over to you for this discussion of counseling in stuttering treatment.
I started with that whole notion that content-based counseling. We as SLPs and have an obligation to deal with content. We have it, and our clients don't. We need to be judicious about it, and we need to learn to be comfortable with the affect, with the feeling realm, because our clients dwell in that in a lot of respects. Counseling, stuttering engenders a lot of anxiety and a lot of feelings of pain, of isolation, and so on, that need to be out on the table to be discussed. I repeat again, that this is all normal. This is all because our clients are upset and they're not emotionally disturbed. And the realm of emotional disturbance belongs to the mental health professional. But here, for us to be effective, feelings need to be part of it. Now, the other counseling strategy that I think is ineffective is advice giving. That I see this a lot in our field, and advice giving is seldom helpful. Whenever we say what the client should do, it's a one-way street. It's I'm up, you're down. It increases client dependency when we do that. And the goal of counseling, and here I'm getting to a fuller definition of it for me, is to create an independent client who no longer needs us. And we do this best by not giving advice and not giving information when it's not needed or available for the client to hear. Then we overwhelm client. So counseling encourages the personal growth in the client. It creates independence. We're always seeking to enhance their self-esteem, and we do this best by listening to client, valuing client, and trusting that client will eventually know what's best for themselves and that the wisdom resides within the client and not within us as the counselor slash therapist.
Can I just give a piece of that back to you for your comment? So the reason I want to highlight something you just said is I can't even count how many times I've heard a professional say, I don't do counseling. I'm not a psychologist. And from what I understood, you just said so much of stuttering are really normal reactions to a very challenging situation, but they're normal. So, you know, a person who never speaks in class because they might stutter, while that might seem extreme for people who stutter, that's fairly normal. And you're making a distinction between that and somebody who may have a very deep rooted psychological problem or depression. Did I get that about right?
You got it right.
Perfect. Yes. So I'll let you continue, sir.
So the strategy that I like is the one of coming out of humanistic psychology, which says that wisdom resides within the client and the other, and that our job as counselors is to create the environment that enables client to feel safe, emotionally safe. And this we do by our non-judgmental listening and our deep listening to the client and valuing the client as a person. And I think people can understand that and feel that when you're in a relationship where you're being listened to and the counselor is reflecting back what you're saying, is not giving advice, not giving you information when you're not asking for it or ready for it, but is there and is present and is witnessing and giving you a chance to talk. You know, we seldom have a chance to really express ourselves. It's a great gift that we can give to the other by just listening and witnessing and allowing people to express themselves. We seldom get a chance for that. In particular, we seldom get a chance to grieve. And stuttering is a loss. So there are many losses involved in stuttering, and so there's a lot of grief in that. And we need to be able to do that. When we start grieving, when we start feeling bad in most environments, people around us want to make us feel better. It's a sort of intuitive response is to try to make people feel better and telling them why you shouldn't feel bad. You know, they do this in a number of different ways, one of which in stuttering in particular, well, of all the disorders I could have or my son could have, stuttering is minor compared to all of the others. And the purpose of that is to make you feel better. Actually, it's to make the person who you're talking to feel better. But it doesn't work, because what it does is it makes you feel guilty because you feel badly because you stutter or your child stutters. This is a strategy that's very ineffective, and it just adds another element of guilt. The goal of stuttering isn't to make you feel better, as we said, but in the course of counseling, these painful feelings should emerge. And as I said, when they're embraced, I think that's the first step to healing. But I think there'll always be some pain associated with stuttering, and that just needs to be acknowledged, not worked at to try to make feel better, because that fails miserably every time.
This is Stutter Talk. I am Peter Reitzes speaking to Dr. David Luderman, who wrote the book Counseling Persons with Communication Disorders and Their Families, now in its fifth edition. So let me share with you one challenging part of the work that I do that I think relates to exactly to what you just said. So when a parent of a preschooler asks me, what are the chances, or of a school-age child asks me, what are the chances that my child is going to stop stuttering or outgrow their stuttering? Well, we know for some children, depending on their age, there's an 80% chance. And so the parent wants to know, and if you give them the straight data, the research, then sometimes the parent may feel, well, my goodness, my child is one of the 20% who didn't outgrow stuttering. What did I do wrong? So I think it's one of the challenges of the job is how to give information, I think, so you don't make the parent feel even worse.
You know, you have to judge at first whether information is what's needed here, or is there a deeper question on this? And very often, when people seem to be seeking information, they're not. Well, when they look at, for example, the causes of deafness, and they ask you what causes deafness, you could give a dissertation at length, I'm sure, about what are the possible causes, but if you really think about it, the question really reflects usually guilt. What did I do, or did I do something to cause my child to be deaf, stuttering? And we sometimes need to reflect that, and it's what I call an affect response. And I think when they're asking on cure, like you are, I wouldn't give that statistic at all. As we know, cure is a funny term in fluency disorders, because there are fluent kids who are real stutterers because of all the avoidances that they do. So it's that emotional, for me, as I look at fluency, it's feeling fluent in spite of having a lot of non-fluencies. I think you're not a stutterer then. I think the stuttering is the stuff that's going on internally.
Yes, I totally agree with you. The below the surface iceberg stuff, absolutely. And just to follow up on one more point, you were talking about the importance of grieving. Can you just take a moment on that for people who are not familiar? So what would a child who stutters or an adult who stutter, how would they grieve about their stuttering?
Well, grief is always a loss. And there's a loss in the comfort, I think, for me, as I look at fluency, in the comfort and the ease of relationship in any number of different contexts. So there's a feeling of sadness, things I can't do that other people seem to be doing so easily. And that needs to be acknowledged. And that's a grief reaction. And grief is something that fairly long lasting, and something that most people, as I said, don't handle it well, because then they start trying to make you feel better. So we need to acknowledge it. To use the vernacular, we need to be able to say, you know what? Stuttering sucks. And we can go on from there with people. But when we try to fix it and make it better, you know, that it defeats ourselves, because by fixing it, making it better, curing it, we're acknowledging that they're doing something very wrong and bad. And that just reinforces the grief reaction. So we need to acknowledge, yep, there's some the fluency problem here. And then we can begin to start dealing with how we can behave to make it more comfortable for client and for the parent.
Hmm. And I just a note to listeners, occasionally you refer to your work with deaf and hard of hearing clients, and that's because you are an audiologist, correct?
Right. Yes. And I, I slip sometimes.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I've read your work in audiology, and it's just as meaningful. I mean, pain is pain, and dealing with pain is dealing with pain. So it's, I find it very valuable. And I just want to share with you that the deep listening you were talking about, I was in speech therapy in my early 20s with a speech therapist who's excellent and really did a lot of that deep listening. And I think he offered me that space to really come to terms and to grieve in my own eyes that I wasn't going to be a normal speaker. It was almost by going to speech therapy and talking about my stuttering, it was probably the first time where I said to myself, you know, I am a stutterer. This is how I talk. But it also was the first time I felt like there was a space to do it differently and to change it and to take control of it. So I think that's what you mean when you're talking about grief and loss, correct?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. Yes, it's to get comfortable with who you are. And oddly enough, I think the more comfortable you get, the more fluent you get too. I think it tends to work that way.
Yeah, we've had quite a few guests say that on Stutter Talk over the years, both people who stutter and other professionals. Dr. Luderman, can you move us into counseling caveats?
Yeah, the caveats are the things that I think interfere with that relationship building that needs to happen in order, I think, for therapy to be successful. I think one of the things is stereotyping. It's very easy for us to just assume all sorts of things about somebody, but without or seeing them. Once we get some characteristics of them, and we make all kinds of assumptions. So what I've learned, and it's taken me a long time to learn it, is to just accept people for who they are. And I had a marvelous prof who used to say, we are all a marvelous experiment of one. And to be able to sit and listen to our client, so that when I say stereotyping, what I mean is that the cure for stereotyping is to begin every encounter with client as from a listening stance, to be able to let client speak, let client reveal self, and then we can begin to figure out how's the best way that we can help client. We have to understand denial and that role that denial plays. This is a critical component of coping. And most people see denial as a negative, but I see it as a very positive way of coping. It ensures a kind of psychological safety for us. It's when we're in situations in which we feel overwhelmed. And when we do that, we need to have some mechanism, and it's built into us, in which we can cope with situations that are overwhelming. I mean, the simplest example of this is I'm driving my car and the engine starts making funny noises, and I you know what I do with that? I put on my radio. And it makes more noises. I would put the radio on louder. What I'm saying to myself and to the world at large is, you know what? I can't deal with this right now. And that's because I don't have the skills to deal with this. And so if you're my therapist and you see me doing this and you tell me how foolish it is for me to do this, I'll agree with you. And I'll go passive aggressive now, because if I have no other strategy, I have nothing else to fall back on, I'm going to deny. So, then I won't tell you about my putting the radio on. So when people give up denial, they're never pushed out of denial. You have to see denial is a result of my not having another strategy. So what a counselor must do is not attack denial directly at all, must look for the underlying anxiety about the occasion and deal with that, build up the confidence. It's a self-confidence issue, denial, and it's a content issue in the sense of not having the skill set to deal with it. So that if you increase my skills and my confidence, then I give up denial because now I think I have a shot. So if you give me a course in engine mechanics, I'll pull over the car to the side of the road and I'll investigate and now be more effective in my behavior. So that what I've seen so often, and particularly this is with parents and professionals, is the professional gets to thinking about how the parent is kind of screwing up their kid. And it's because the parent is in denial. Another issue that I think confounds the parent, the professional relationship with clients is what I call implicit expectations. We need to make our expectations. This is what's known as contracting. We never quite make our expectations very clear to client. This always comes around responsibility assumption very often. It's what we expect the client to do and what we are prepared to do. And once there is a meeting of those expectations, then we can go on. In my personal life, if I don't make explicit what I want and expect from the other, then when it's not met, I get angry. And when we have a lot of conflict, it's usually because I have implicit expectations that haven't been met, but I haven't made them obvious. In my personal life, it would be when I come home from work expecting to have a nice dinner with my wife and she's invited the neighbors over, I get angry. But I know I didn't say anything about it, so I have the dinner, but at the same time, I'm kind of fuming. And then when my wife messes up the checkbook, I will fight and get angry at her with the checkbook because she's guilty of the previous offense. In the same way, we do this with clients. When we get angry at clients, it's usually because we've had an expectation that they're not meeting. It goes to, I think, very often about fluency and the clients expecting us to make them normal. And we're recognizing that normality is more about how they feel about their fluency than about the actual fluency. So unless we really make that explicit, we're going to be in conflict.
Can I share with you something?
Sure.
One of my very first clients in private practice over a decade ago was an adult who stutters. And everything he wanted to do in speech therapy was fluency driven. So he didn't want to hear the word stuttering. And he, at some point, he said to me very angrily, you know, this being the treatment, this isn't helping me. And I really think what he meant was, I'm still stuttering. So I think we had very different expectations of what we were doing. So from my perspective, I wasn't so sure that, you know, chasing fluency for 20 years and then continuing to chase it in speech therapy was really a productive way to go. And from his perspective, I mean, he thought that the goal should be the complete absence of stuttering. So I think that goes to a little bit of what you're talking about here.
Oh, it sure does. Now, another issue here is overhelping. This is you know, where the client, and I'm really talking here about ownership. Client has to take ownership of the problem. They come to us to expect us to fix it. And we recognize that it really has to be a collaborative effort, and that our goal isn't to fix it necessarily, but to help them come to grips with it. So this relates also to what you were just talking about with the expectations that are different. But, you know, you're not going to get any really meaningful progress unless client takes ownership of the problem. If you're just there to fix it and client is not taking ownership, then the result is not going to be very good. And I think this is particularly true with parents. I want to talk about parents, but I'll do this in another context. Because parents, you know, bring the child to you to fix it, the problem, and they withdraw. But they need to take ownership as well. So the other issue I want to talk about is the one about being a cheerleader and making people feel better. That's not the goal of counseling. And counseling is not your job is not to make people feel better. And if you do your job well, a lot of those painful feelings should be emerging. And so we need to get off of the cheerleading perspective. And the last I want to talk about a bit is projection. Very often we project our feelings, our experience. And I think this is the danger of having a therapist who himself or herself is non-fluent and has been through it. I think it's marvelous. You have an interesting kind of validity. The danger is that you expect your client to be like you. And each client is marvelously different, and they have different values, different expectations, different life experiences. We mustn't put our values and our experiences out on the client. We can share them. And at appropriate times, sharing ourselves is a very appropriate kind of response. But we need to also respect clients' different choices and life choices than ours.
Every time you say something, I get like three comments or questions in my head. But I really like what you just said about how, you know, it's okay to cheerlead, but maybe you could comment on this too, where, you know, my speech therapists who are excellent really did support me and were cheerleaders, but perhaps more importantly, they just made me feel more normal. Like anything I told them about how I reacted and dealt with stuttering was normal to them, was just, yes, I understand. I still remember one saying, I believe you. And that to me was even more important than somebody cheering me on, was just, yeah, this is normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What that triggers for me is how incredibly, and when we get into the therapy part of this, more actual therapy, how important that a support group is, where you have others stutterers sharing their experiences with you. That really validates your own experience, and you recognize how normal you are. But the therapist, and the therapist can do this very easily. Not very easily, but does it by not reacting in any way, not trying to make you feel better, but saying, yeah, of course.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up support groups, because when you were talking about denial and how a therapist can help a person see their options, I immediately thought of support groups like the National Stuttering Association, where just without aggressively, you know, pushing anything about stuttering, just having a child in a room with other children who stutter or adults and seeing people respond to stuttering and deal with it in a healthy manner, in an open and fun manner, very powerful stuff.
Yeah, it normalizes it.
Yeah.
And because the feeling has been, and there, a lot of people around have been pathologizing it. But this normalizes it.
I just want to highlight one more of your counseling caveats. If I understood you correctly, you were basically saying to the therapist, hey, therapist, you know, people who stutter and their families aren't as fragile as we might think. Could you just take a moment on that?
Yes, they aren't. Thank you for highlighting that. I think we tend to think that. I think parents in particular feel that way about their children, that they're experiencing so much trouble that they have to then overprotect. But we as professionals tend to also, I think, not hold them to a standard of conduct, both the kids and the parents. And that's what I mean by they're taking ownership and not overprotecting and overhelping them. We create dependent clients when we do that, and we don't allow them to grow. So trusting the parents and trusting the kids to grow and to take the information that they have and use it in a way that's helpful, and are sitting back and letting them take charge. It's hard to do because we used to go in there, and I used to go in there, and I had an agenda. I had a lesson plan. I was pretty sure what the goal was and would sort of impose it. But that would create the dependency. If I step back and create vacuums, they have to act, and they have to take control and responsibility. It's a matter of being responsive to the client, not responsible for the client.
So just to highlight some things that you just said, or to summarize it, you're saying if you listen deeply, if you give people the chance to talk and express themselves, you're really going to help them, like you're trusting them to find their own way in dealing with these issues, with, of course, your input and guidance.
Yes. That's exactly right.
This is Stutter Talk. I'm Peter Reitzis here with Dr. David Luderman, Professor Emeritus at Emerson College in Boston. So, Dr. Luderman, two big topics that we're going to discuss is treatment and families. Could you start with treatment, please?
Actually, I want to talk here not so much treatment, because my expertise is certainly not in molding fluency or any of the strategies per se. But what I want to talk about is some counseling techniques here of ways of eliciting the feelings and of the relationship and the kinds of responses that we can make to the client. And I've talked about content. And again, I remind you that we do have a content mandate, but it needs to be judiciously applied depending on where the client's feelings are. When clients are seeking confirmation, whenever you get advice-seeking questions, you know, what would you do if this was your child? Or, you know, what school is a good school for me to go to? Or who's the best therapist? Questions like that, which seem like they want your advice, they seldom do. Usually what people are seeking is confirmation. They've already made a decision, and they want you to confirm it. So the best response you can give when you sense that kind of question is to ask a question back and find out where they are coming from. So which school might be the best school for my son to attend, I would say to them, have you been to see these schools? If they say no, well, why don't you go to these schools and come back and we'll talk about it, rather than try to give advice and say, if this was my kid, I would put him here. Because then, again, it's that ownership issue. You become the fish giver. You become the one who's giving the advice. That will create the dependency. Or they go away from you saying, oh, he's so dumb, he didn't know what's the best thing to do either. Either way is, I think, a bad result. What I call the affect response is one that looks for the feeling level. So that if a parent says to me that question that I think we all get at one point or another, is if this was your child, what would you do? I might say, it sounds to me you're feeling pretty overwhelmed right now. Or this is a big responsibility to you, isn't it? And you'd like to find somebody that would solve this for you and take the responsibility for you. And so then we could start talking about this whole issue of responsibility assumption, feeling scared, which most parents, if you get down to the basis, run scared. It's a lot of responsibility. The same thing, what causes stuttering? That's almost always a guilt issue. It's almost that parent's got some notion about what she or he might have done, some incident when the kid was two or three, or some failure in her pregnancy, or something like that. And that's what I call the guilty secret. If they ever share it with you, it's a great gift. But they will if you're in a non-judgmental stance with them and can say something like, it's so easy to feel guilty when you have a child with a fluency disorder. Or if you ask a question back again, do you think you did something that may have caused your child to stutter? So, you see, if you gave just content to that of the causes of stuttering, you turn it into a whole different direction. There's a sharing self response here too. What I'd like us to be as professionals is authentic. By that I mean real person in a real relationship, willing to share our own feelings. So, you know, one of the problems is, one of the issues I think for professionals is, do I cry, for example, when a client cries? And I think it's great. I think weeping just with them, it shows you as a caring person in a relationship and being authentic. I don't mean necessarily talking about your personal life, but I mean being willing to tell them how much you like them, being willing to tell them you're angry with them, and willing to be real with clients.
And clients like that. They like it when we're real, right?
Yes, I think they appreciate it. I remember one father said to me, I love to go to school and see the teacher have problems with my kid. Because it validates his own experience at home.
Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes in speech therapy with stuttering, the clinician will get a challenging question. So if you're doing speech therapy and a person who stutters says to you, well, why should I do that speech tool? I'm just going to stutter anyway. What could be one possible response to that type of a challenging question?
Sounds like you don't like what I'm giving you to do right now.
So you ask a question back.
Usually that's right. drives clients crazy.
Yeah.
Ask a question back. Or what does it reflect? See, what's the question reflect? What's the territory behind it? It sounds to me like when you get that challenging question, they're pretty ticked at you. So now this is an invitation. So let's talk about us here right now in our relationship. And it's a marvelous opportunity to get to the contract. I have a hunch that that kind of challenging question is an issue of that implicit expectation stuff.
So can you talk to us about the importance of reframing questions or comments from your clients?
Yeah, well, reframing it's a different thing here than just questions from clients, because reframing is taking this to another level. I think when the client gives me something, I'm always thinking about what's behind that question, and not always treating them as content questions. So what's the feeling there? Well, what do they really seem to be asking me? But their reframing is another dimension here. It's in a lot of ways, it's a healing way. I think it's a marvelous skill that we have, a capacity that we have as human beings, that events in the world have only meaning that we give to it, and that we have a choice to give to it. This is the glass half empty or is the glass half full? Well, the answer to that is it depends on how we want to see it. And we have this ability to see things in very different ways. So stuttering can be a tragedy, or, you know, it's a marvelous teacher. It brings out in us all sorts of capacities that would otherwise lie latent. For a lot of us in the field, I mean, stuttering and fluency disorders has given meaning to our lives. It's given us a direction to go in. It's a frustrator, but it also increases other kinds of capacities. So it's reframing it. You have to be really careful. Some of my favorite reframings are, for example, after a diagnostic, when I would be diagnosing a child as having a hearing loss, I might turn to the parent and say, well, this child has ensured you an interesting life. A good reframing sort of gets you to sort of think, wow, it's just a different way of looking at this.
Well, it changed my life when I said to my speech therapist, I stuttered really badly today, and he smiled and said, you've been stuttering pretty well. That's a good life changer. Or when you come in and you say, oh man, I've been just stuttering all over the place today. And therapist says, well, it sounds like you have a lot of chances to work on your stuttering today.
That's good
stuff, man.
it just changes it around. And then sort of get an aha experience from a good reframing. Yeah, it's a marvelous skill we have.
So you've talked about content responses, effect responses, counter questions, reframing, sharing self. What about silence? Can you talk about silence?
Silence is, you know, I had it under techniques in my book, and I would change it now if I think about it.
Okay.
Silence for me is when I have no agenda. Just means to me, and I do this in groups, it's not like I'm doing something deliberate. Is I have no agenda, because I'm giving the control over to the client. So this is your arena. What do you want to do? And that's just it. It's genuine. It's real. If I'm doing this as a technique because I want to keep quiet and because I read the book or heard this lecture, it's usually not an effective strategy, because you're sitting there more anxious than the client is. But when I'm doing silence, I'm not anxious at all. I'm there in a listening stance. And so it's not a technique so much as it's being authentic. Once I've gotten this whole notion that that client has the wisdom, not me, then silence just flows from that. And I'm not sitting there with a technique. It's just me right now. I have nothing to say, but I'm eagerly listening and ready to listen to you.
This is Stutter Talk. Peter Reitz is here with Dr. David Luderman. Dr. Luderman, could you share with us one more counseling technique?
Yeah, well, I call these the affirmations. These are the things you can say for almost every occasion. And again, but they have to be genuine. They have to flow from you. The aha, which is, I'm here, I'm listening, tell me more response. The that's okay, which is when client reveals feelings and painful material and stuff that ordinarily is kept hidden. But here you're being non-judgmental and giving permission. It's a giving permission response. And then the third response that you can give is, it must be so hard. And that's the empathetic response. And that will usually bring tears. And we can say this, and we have to mean it, but it's so easy. It must be so hard for you in any speaking situation when you're so anxious. And that will enable the client to start grieving. What we must do is we must give clients permission and acknowledge them. And by making empathetic responses, never saying, I understand, but saying it must be so hard, or giving permission. I remember one time I was doing a support group for parents, and a mother is looking at me as she's sitting down, and she looks me square in the face and says, you're going to make me cry. And I said, no, I'm going to give you permission to cry. And she started to cry. And that's what we must do, create that kind of environment that enables people to cry. And the last area I want to talk to you about is the parent piece of this, which I think is so important, or the spouse piece of it, or anybody who's in part of the family system. Because I think we need to deal with at the systems level. And I think in fluency in particular, I don't see this very much. Everybody acknowledges how important parents are, but then the parent is usually relegated to the waiting room while the therapist works with the kid and then comes out and gives them a brief summary of the therapy and a 5-minute session with the parents. I think this is not the way to do it, because that's essentially client-centered approach rather than a family-centered approach. I think the parent has to be an integral part of therapy. I think you have to see the parent as a equal recipient of your expertise as a professional. When you do that, it causes a paradigmatic shift in your thinking. If you can really put the parent as part of that therapeutic process and an integral part of it, not the one who writes the check, not the one who's sitting in the waiting room, not the one who provides transportation, but an integral part of that encounter and that endeavor. And when you do that, when you're working at that level, it's so much more efficient than working at just the identified patient level, because you then create a milieu, a home environment that's fully supportive of the stuttering behavior and of what they're trying to accomplish and what you're trying to accomplish as a professional. So I would urge not only an approach that values clients, that looks at is willing to explore with clients the feelings engendered by this disorder, but also looking at and working at the family level.
I will share with you that when I read your book for probably the third time or second time in my life, I was dating my wife or who would become my wife. And I remember taking out a list of your responses to use on the date, like the counter question, the affirmation. And I remember like practicing with her during conversation. And I told her about it. And I have to say, they're good dating tools, you know.
I've never thought of them in those terms.
Well, if you go through it and you stick to, you get away from the content response and you stick to the reframing and the affirmation and then the silence.
Sure. Yeah, my wife asks for it very often. And I'm not sure I give it to her because I become a husband. I want to fix it and make it better for her.
So actually, let me ask you just one last fun question. I don't know if it'll get in the show or not. So Dr. Luderman, when I first started out as a speech language pathologist, someone gave me what I think turned out to be some really good advice. They said to me, when you're in a session, it's if you can throw in "tell me more" a bunch of times. So say to your client as they're talking to you and there's a moment of silence, "tell me more." What do you think of that type of advice?
Sure. I don't do it that explicitly. I tend to do it with the but I use that phrase very often. "Tell me more about this," or "what would that look like if the parent says, 'I really screwed up today.'" I might say, "what would that look like?" Or "tell me more," or I might just say, "uh-huh." But they're all seeking to elicit more from the client and saying, "you know what, I'm here. I'm not judging you. Bring it forth." Good advice. And thank you for giving me a chance to talk about these topics, which are so close to my heart.
Thank you so much for all of your time. I know this will be a very special episode.
Okay. You're very welcome, Peter. Good luck.